Rewind, your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This program is brought to you from the Margaret Farrow Studio.
This week on Rewind, your week in review. Former Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes announces his campaign for governor. Plus, the USDA threatens to withhold federal food assistance to Democratic-led states, including Wisconsin. And the lawsuit to redraw Wisconsin's congressional maps moves forward. All that and more on Rewind, your week in review for December 5th.
I'm Anya Van Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Welcome back. Happy Thanksgiving to us all. We have 2 weeks' worth of news to catch up on. So we're going to start with what's been going on with SNAP over the last little while. So this is unrelated to all the conversations we had during the shutdown about SNAP. But earlier this week, the USDA and Agriculture Secretary Brooke Rollins threatened to withhold funds from all 21 Democratic-led states that are currently withholding data about SNAP recipients. So in a cabinet meeting, she said that as of next week, we have begun and will begin to stop moving federal funds into those states until they comply and they tell us and allow us to partner with them to root out this fraud and to protect the American taxpayer. So backing up a couple of months, the USDA had requested all states to submit certain personal data about SNAP recipients, names, addresses, immigration status, how long they've been on the program, that kind of thing. Republican-led states did, Democratic-led states did not, and also filed a lawsuit saying that this is an invasion of privacy. And so the argument from the Trump administration is that this roots out fraud in the system. Governor Tony Evers and other Democratic leaders have said that they audit their systems and they're confident in them. There was a preliminary injunction in October over that lawsuit. And so the date that we're kind of looking towards is Monday, December 8th. That is when states, including Wisconsin, have been told they either need to comply with that request or provide a clear explanation of why they're not. And we've been told by the governor's office that there will be an update in the meantime, but that's kind of the big change that might be coming.
Yeah, well, and Monday is also important because in that lawsuit, there's a stipulation right now that says USA, you can't take money away from these states until at least the 8th. Like, the deadline was the 1st. They moved it back to the 8th, so that's kind of on hold. And the governor's office is kind of, we'll see. There's more court action, I assume, is going to come up. But there's also other stuff with SNAP going on that's interesting because separate from this, the One Big Beautiful Act changed SNAP for us in Wisconsin and other states and how we pay for it. So traditionally, it's been a 50-50 split administrative costs. The One Big Beautiful Act changed that to 75% for the states, 25% for the feds. We need to come up with that money eventually to administer the program. And there's a second piece that's also interesting. It's called an error rate. So if you're on the program, you have to be eligible in the program, right? And so the states have to do these checks. If you have errors, if you have people who are not supposed to be eligible on there, you get dinged. Our error rate in 2024, the last year available, is about 4.5%. The cutoff is 6%. If you go above that, you start losing money. Like, you have to pay for SNAP yourself. So administrative costs are shared, but the program, the benefits are basically all federal money. But if you go the error rate, you got to pick up the cost. Go above 10%, and you're talking like $100 million plus is what you lose a year. So DHS, Department of Health Services, has this plan that introduced like in the fall. Said, okay, here's what we want to do. We want to, one, allocate money in the 2 years of the budget to take care of the administrative costs, but two, we want to hire 56 new people to be part of these checks because as well as doing the checks, you can no longer do phone checks. You have to actually do either a video check or in person. We need to make sure we stabilize the error rate. It's interesting. They justify the 56 by saying, we think our error is going to go up in 2025. That will be out in June, I think, of this year. And we're assuming like kind of worst case scenario, we're going to assume we're going to start at 13% for error rate. That would be very bad, by the way. And then if you have 56 new people, you can go out and you have checks and knock it down below 6%. Started picking up word this week that Republicans have talked about basically doing the fix DHS wants, but getting a win out of it, win in quote marks, by attaching this whole thing to a bill that would ban the purchase of soda and candy with SNAP funds. So there was talk about extraordinary recession, which is when lawmakers call themselves back in to take something up for the end of the year. that was brought up last week in a senators only call for Republicans. The fact we're now Friday, a week and a half later, haven't done it, so they're kind of running out of time, but they know they have something to fix. We'll see that comes up sometime soon. Keep an eye out for a trade-off of the governor saying, I don't like your bill about soda and candy, but I need this money to keep us whole on this program, so maybe we can strike a deal some way on that.
Yes, it'll be really interesting to see, again, that kind of push and pull between the feds and the state level and as that court case continues. Also big news on the campaign front, so another kind of will he, won't he about Mandela Barnes. For weeks there had been pretty clear signals, I think, that the answer was will he, and indeed, officially as of this week, he will. He is in for governor. So he's joining this increasingly kind of crowded Democratic field. Why is it a big deal if we kind of knew that this was coming?
Because it's official, and now we kind of think we have a front runner. And I say kind of think we do, because the perception has been Mandela Barnes ran in 2022 for the U.S. Senate, came within 27,000 votes of Ron Johnson, has name ID from that, and has a great fundraising list. He raised $41 million in change in that race, more than Johnson raised by about $5 million, that makes him a formidable candidate. The question is that name ID still good, or is it soured somewhat? It's really, really interesting. The 2022 race is like this political Rorschach test in the Capitol. But some Democrats say, look, this guy, he outraised Johnson, but if you look at like the outside groups, he got outspent by a lot. I think he's like $80 million to $50 million, $80 million for the pro-Johnson side, $50 million for the pro-Barnes side. He has a good year for Democrats, but the National Democrats left Barnes on his own, essentially, for 3 or 4 weeks after the primary. He got pounded on crime. It still came to 1 percentage point of like beating this guy. You know, he's a formal candidate. Other Democrats go, it was a great year for Democrats in Wisconsin. Tony Evers won by 3.4 percentage points, which is a landslide by Wisconsin standards sometimes. And Mandela ran thousands of votes behind him. There's a reason for that. What is it? Is it because he was viewed soft on crime? Was it the holding up of a t-shirt that says abolish ICE? Was it, did race play a role in it? You know, boring old white guy, young dynamic black man, you know, who knows? But the fact is, he ran behind Tony Evers, and why? And so some Democrats are afraid that Mandela would be make it tougher to win next year. There's also this kind of like, I don't know if nitpicking is the right word, but kind of like he's got a history of baggage and pays property taxes on time one time. And you know, look, hey, people in their 30s, I sound like I'm old, but you know, people in their 30s, sometimes they fall behind on things. That happens in life. But if you're in political office, you shouldn't fall behind on those things. Right? That's the argument. So he's very much a polarizing figure in the primary. The question I'm looking for is, one, he's getting in now. What will he have for fundraising in mid-January? I mean, like, you're getting in late. You're giving a narrow window. So if you raise very little, it's going to be like, okay, what's going on? How do the other Democrats, what do they turn in for number in mid-January? And we're going to see polling, I'm sure, off and on that's going to show, hey, Mandela's in the lead. That's pure name ID. That is pure, who do I know? So can Sarah Rodriguez or David Crowley or, you know, Kelda Royce, pick your Democrat, Francesca Hung, can they somehow find the resources to build up that name ID to be on par with Mandela Barnes?
Right, there's always that kind of overlap of time versus money. Mm-hmm. You need enough money to get you to the finish line, and so if you have too much time, do you run out of money? If you don't have enough time, how does anyone know who you are? And so there's all these kind of calculations at play. That's also why I have kind of the open question of who else is going to throw their name in. Have we kind of reached the end of the line for if you want to have a competitive race? We did see another candidate drop out, Ryan Strnad, who's one of these kind of more... you know, a person whose photo we don't even include in the graphics because we have this sort of clear, established people. And then there are a handful of other candidates who come in with either a particular issue or just kind of to draw attention to one particular thing. So this is one of these people. He was a working class, you know, sort of representative in Milwaukee, a Brewers Stadium employee. Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of the issue. So he dropped out. Are you anticipating anyone else kind of jumping in at this point?
So Joel Brennan, former administration secretary for Tony Evers, very involved in Milwaukee stuff over the years. He's been talking about it. You don't do media interviews the way he's done them if you're not going to run. So anticipate him getting in. And then it becomes a question of lanes. We talk about lanes in politics all the time. Like, what is your lane? So David Crowley, you go, okay, Milwaukee lane, right? Kelda Royce and Francesca Hung, Madison lane, you know, more progressive. Mandela's an interesting one because he's from Milwaukee, but he's something viewed more of a Madison liberal than he is like a Milwaukee Democrat. I know this might sound weird, but that's kind of like the view of him. So is he going to crowd out Francesca and Kelda? We'll see. Joel Brennan, look at the graphic. He's a white guy. And I don't mean to say that flippantly, but, you know, boring white guys have won primaries in Wisconsin before. Is that his lane, or is it a more pro-business one? Well, you got Missy Hughes, from a former WEDIC secretary. She's in the business. They're getting crowded all of a sudden. So, again, who's got the money, the name ID, and then who's going to throw the proverbial political punch? In 2022, when Mandela was running for U.S. Senate, Sarah Galuski, Alex Lazary, Tom Nelson a little bit, but Sarah and Alex did not go after Mandela. They couldn't be sure it would work, or they would bounce back on them because they went negative, and two, that it wouldn't benefit their rival. So Alex Lazary spent like $15 million about his name ID being positive and never caught Mandela Barnes. So in this primary, how much do you need to catch Mandela name ID-wise, and will you throw that proverbial punch on the way trying to reach him?
And then another just quick election update. There's another candidate for the 7th Congressional District, so that's Tom Tiffany's district. And, of course, you know, speaking of the governor's race, there's really been very little change in the Republican lineup. So that's the other open question going into the new year is, will we see a Trump endorsement, and will that kind of shift things, or will other folks get in the race there? But meanwhile, Kevin Hermaning, I hope I am saying that right, a former Marathon County GOP chair, has thrown his name in the race. So he joins Michael Alfonso, Jesse Eben, and Paul Wassgren in that race so far to replace Tom Tiffany.
Hermaning, a financial advisor up there, former Marathon County GOP chair, was a Marine back in the late 70s, taken hostage in the Middle East. Really compelling story. Alfonso, though, 25-year-old son-in-law of Sean Duffy, this group, Northwoods Future PAC, has now spent $850,000 roughly on TV and mail. They're up to their second ad this week. That's a lot of dough to spend in an off-year election, but it shows you that this guy is getting some big backers behind him, and it's paying off on the airwaves. Does the profile, though, I mean, again, not say, sound ancient, but the 7th is not a very young district. So how's a 25-year-old guy appeal to this older electorate up in the 7th Congressional District?
Lots to pay attention to there. Another kind of big thing that happened right before Thanksgiving, so going back in time a little bit, we had this kind of open question about what would happen with the redistricting lawsuits. Would the Supreme Court appoint panels, judicial panels, to hear those lawsuits? And indeed, right before Thanksgiving, they announced that they would. So there are two lawsuits challenging Wisconsin's congressional maps. And there was a requirement set in law by Republicans about 14 years ago saying that any changes to maps need to go before 3-judge panels. This has never been used before. The question was, would it be used this time? And indeed, it will be. So the two lawsuits will proceed in Dane County Circuit Court before these two separate panels. Perhaps not surprisingly, liberal justices decided this. The two conservative justices, Ziegler and Bradley, dissented. They said this is basically like a partisan power grab for Democrats. And then Brian Hagedorn, considered kind of the swing conservative vote, he said that the law does require them to appoint these panels, but that the judges should have been chosen randomly. So what does it tell you, the makeup of these panels, and what are you kind of expecting next?
So one, you've heard conservatives say, well, the fix is in. The Supreme Court of Wisconsin wants new maps, congressional maps, and they'll do anything to get them. Well, if they really wanted that badly, they could have taken up the three previous lawsuits they got asking to draw maps. So go back 2024, Mark Elias, this Dem attorney who's part of current lawsuits, said, hey, you guys return the legislative maps, you should actually the congressional maps. They said no. This summer, another lawsuit from Mark Elias, another group, said, hey, Supreme Court, you should take these maps up and throw them out. They said no. This one's different. This is about the 3-judge panel. So I don't know the court is in, even if the Supreme Court liberal majority thinks there should be a new map, I don't get the impression in my conversations that they are doing things that are like out of the ordinary to like pave the way. This law says if there's an apportionment challenge, you shall appoint these panels. Now, there is a question about what does apportionment mean? The conservative justices, Ziegler and Bradley, took the position that, look, apportionment really is only about when lawmakers draw a map. We, the court, drew the map. You can't have circuit court judges second-guess our work. The liberal majority said, no, actually, this is how it's supposed to work. So all that said about it looks like it's on the up and up, the appointment of the panels kind of go, you couldn't find one token conservative, like just one, to kind of like make it look a little bit different. But we don't have a roadmap. This law from 2011 does not say this is how you shall do it, right? There's not like a timeline. There's not like a, you should go to trial, do it on briefs. It's an open question. We have patterns we could follow. The feds, when they get a challenge of a map, they appoint a three-judge panel. It's in the district. So we're in the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, which includes Indiana, Illinois. So you kind of like pick somebody from each state. And anyway, there are patterns you could go after, but we don't have an actual path laid out. We're feeling our way through this thing right now and trying to figure out what's going to happen. Although I will say, I don't get the impression you'll see a new map by 2026. They keep an eye on this for 2028 at this point.
I mean, that's a big question, is the timing of this. They took quite a long time to figure out whether they were going to appoint these panels. And, of course, there is a congressional election coming up in 11 months, roughly. And so it's sort of, would these panels specifically redraw maps, and then could they possibly do it in time for 2026? Obviously, any kind of election-related court case has to get solved with alacrity. And alacrity is not necessarily on folks' side right now. Also news from the Supreme Court. They are considering a case, original action in Voces de la Frontera versus Gerber. So this is a lawsuit from the ACLU of Wisconsin on behalf of Voces, an immigrants rights group based in Milwaukee, challenging ICE detainers in five counties. So that's Brown, Kenosha, Marathon, Sauk, and Walworth counties. And ICE detainers are, that's when sheriff's offices and local jails kind of keep detained people for up to 48 additional hours who are suspected of being in the country illegally in order to pass them off to ICE. And so what this lawsuit argues is that that amounts to an arrest, but an ICE detainer is an administrative warrant. And so they're saying that in order to participate in that, they would need to be issuing arrest warrants, not administrative warrants. I thought it was interesting. I didn't know until this kind of came forward that most counties in Wisconsin actually do participate in these detainers, but those five counties are responsible for, I believe, 25% of the detainers in the state. And so this will be a really interesting lawsuit to kind of watch, obviously, given the current political landscape around immigration.
Yeah. Interesting note that I got my calls this week. Look, the liberal majority, they are definitely deciding on the side of liberals almost every time, right? But that majority, who is a tribe's activist sometimes by conservatives, they have passed on big cases they could have taken original action on. For example, there was a request to overturn school choice, for example, as a program saying it's not constitutional in Wisconsin. They said, we're not going to take that. This is interesting because they're taking original action, which means it's not going to the lower courts first. There are some lawyers who will argue that when you do this, you run the risk of not developing a full record, and that leads to mistakes sometimes. We've seen in the past Supreme Court decisions or writings where they don't have a full trial court proceeding in the appellate court to kind of get things flushed out, and they make mistakes in the writings. So you run the risk of that. But the point made to me was, why take this one? I mean, an immigration, super hot topic politically. Why is this the one they want to take original action versus going, say, hey, go circuit court first, let's figure it out there, develop the record, come back to us later on.
That'll be really interesting to watch there as well. There was also a report, again, from the sort of pre-Thanksgiving mix of things from DPI. So they are required through Act 20, which is the new literacy law, to submit a report to the legislature kind of about how kids are doing, the youngest kids in the state are doing in terms of reading. They say it's a baseline, it's kind of to guide interventions as they start to put forward the new science of reading laws and other literacy mandated changes. And one of the things that came out is that 36% of kids 4K through third grade are below the 25th percentile for reading. So they're identified as at risk, and that would require a personal reading plan and things like this. And if you take out the four-year-olds, it's more than 40%. Of kindergartens, first graders, second graders, and third graders are reading below the 25th percentile of all kids in the country.
Yeah, so like, let's stress that. It's 25th percent, not like compared to Wisconsin, the entire country, that 25th percentile. That was kind of eye-opening. Now, generally, state superintendent said that this is a starting point. It doesn't talk about the kids' potential, but where we're at. John Jagler, state senator, who's the chair of the education committee, said this is underscores the problem that we have. And for conservatives, this is more evidence to them that our past approach reading has been a failure. They call it cueing system. You use like images to help kids kind of guess the word, essentially. I was based on phonics, you know, like the old system. They're arguing that, look, this is shows you that failed. This is a problem. And so now the kids who score below 25th percentile, they get intervention, you know, reading coaches to help them catch up. Hopefully that all works. I know Will Flanders talked to you guys at public radio about this a little bit and pointed out to a district, Cudahy, I think it is, south of Milwaukee, they actually went to a phonics-based system, a science-based system in 2022 using federal COVID money. They've improved dramatically. They have a high 60-something kids are considered underprivileged. They're still doing quite well in these scores, comparatively speaking. So to the Will, there is an opportunity here for improvement. We shall see how this all plays out, but this really was eye-opening to people about how badly we're doing for kids. And don't forget, these are not like COVID school kids, like, right? So if you're in 4K, 5K, you were born in 2021, right? So this is not that impact. Something else is going on here that's impacting what's going on, happening here.
And so kind of the earliest implementations of Act 20, and so it'll also be, you know, some time to see how the rest of that law kind of plays out in the policy requirements there. We also have a couple updates in terms of how the state is doing business. And so we have kind of the latest from Foxconn, again, right before Thanksgiving. WEDC made the announcement that Foxconn will be expanding in Racine County with $569 million. They say it'll create about 1,300, almost 1,400 new jobs in 4 years. And the state is offering all these tax incentives up to $96 million now through 2029, including $16 million of newly approved performance-based tax incentives, so that by the end of 2024, $700 million at Foxconn, they created about 1,200 jobs. They're saying it'll be a grand total of about 2,600 jobs and $1.2 billion in capital investment by the end of 2029. That's kind of a fraction of the initially promised 13,000 jobs, $10 billion in investment, but that's kind of the latest projections.
So Foxconn, remember, huge possible incentives they could have gotten for a huge investment. The U.S. administration took an approach that the way the contract was written under the Walker folks, that there was an opportunity that Foxconn could sue us and say, yeah, we haven't hit your marks according to you, but we think we have, therefore you owe us the money. Now, others say that wasn't a big risk, that this thing was done properly, that it was tied to creation. If they didn't create the jobs, you get the money, so no problem. But Evers basically said, I'm going to lower my risk and do it this way. This new deal is basically like a typical incentive grant program. This is kind of how things work for any company, not just Foxconn. Now, the Foxconn's reputation, will it actually deliver what's promising? That's the big thing with Foxconn. Like, they've kind of fallen short here in other places with their promises, but we'll see. They're doing something down there. And if they do it properly, they'll get paid.
And another deal kind of right around the corner from where we are. We're currently in downtown Madison. And, you know, Governor Evers has said that he has this intention of trying to sell off state buildings that are underutilized, kind of save taxpayer money in that way. And so the Department of Administration is selling 1 West Wilson. That was the first non-capital government office mm-hmm. building. And so that is now kind of officially on the market if anyone has a couple zillion dollars lying around to redevelop a beautiful Art Deco building
yes.
downtown.
And the Evers folks have been trying to move people around to try and get them out of 2 buildings downtown. One is 1 West Wilson. The other is, we call them the Jeff buildings, Jeff 1, 2, and 3. They're trying to get people out of one of those and then sell them separately. Part of this is that the Evers folks have gone to more of a remote option to work. And you need that flexibility to have less office space. Republican lawmakers don't like that remote option so much. They're not sure that state employees are doing their jobs. They want them to be back in the office. To have them back in the office, you need those buildings. To need those buildings, you put millions of dollars of work into them to keep them going. So it'll be interesting because once they go get these bids back, I think by mid-March, they have to go to the Building Commission, which is split between Democrats and Republicans, say, hey, we want to sell this building. What do you guys say?
So always a political fight, even when it comes to real estate. That brings us to the stock report. And rising this week is Chief Justice Jill Karofsky.
Because she's got the power back, which she used to have before, well, the old Chief Justice used to have. So, look, when liberals took over the majority in 2023, they changed the structure of how the court works. This is very law dork stuff, all right, let's be honest. But the Chief Justice for years dictated the calendar, how things went, what was going on. Liberals said, wait a second, we've got the majority. We've got a conservative Chief Justice, Annette Ziegler. We don't like that. We're going to have a 3-justice panel now with 2 of ours and 1 of yours. That panel will set the calendar. That panel will kind of run the court. Annette Ziegler really did not like that, said they were usurping her authority. It was against the Constitution. Well, last week, the same day they issued the orders on the congressional map cases, they issued this order saying we're going back to the Chief Justice, they have this power and this power. We still have these restrictions on like how long you have to write your briefs or your decision, that kind of thing. But we're restoring basically the old system. Now, Annette Ziegler Brian Hagedorn and Rebecca Bradley, the conservatives, had some things to say about this. Rebecca Bradley was the harshest, saying essentially, I never recognized this thing in the first place, so nobody should pay attention to it. Annette rehashed all these injustices in her mind that happened. Brian also went, this thing didn't work very well, it wasn't clean. But both Annette and Brian, who are going to stay in the court after next year, and work with the liberals a little bit, said, you know, we have hope for the future. Maybe we move past this and be a better court, more collegial, we'll see. I think people are kind of skeptical that's going to happen. The court's been strained for a long time. But it's an interesting point was raised to me this week that we in Wisconsin changed how the Chief Justice was picked back a few years back because Shirley Abramson, longest tenured justice, got the Chief Justice's role. And Shirley had that role even though she was in the minority. In fact, a 5-2 minority, I think it was at one point, when she was there. But she was dictating the court, and Republicans liked that. So they got a constitutional amendment passed that said, no, the court shall elect the Chief Justice. Well, that thing was passed in April. By May, they kicked her out. They said, as soon as that thing is certified, we're going to elect somebody new. The terms, though, run from August 1st to July 31st. So you have this weird situation where every couple of years, it's a two-year term, you could have a liberal majority pick a justice with a conservative majority coming in. So let's just say this spring. Brad Schimmel lost to Susan Crawford. But if Brad Schimmel had won, the outgoing liberal majority would have elected Chief Justice for two more years, majority flipping on August 1st. It's a weird thing in state law how it works. Anyway, that's a little bit law dorkdom for you. The bottom line, though, is Jill Carassi is going to run the show, essentially, like it used to be, for years and years and years until the liberals changed it because they're not Ziegler.
And so that brings us to mixed Congressman Brian Stile.
So if you're going to beat Stile, you need a perfect storm, pretty much. You need the right environment, which I think we're probably seeing nationally. You need a good candidate. Don't really have that right now. No offense to the guys who are running, but they're not raising a whole lot of money. New maps would help a whole lot. That map thing is what people are watching with Stile, because Derek Van Orden over in the third, he's definitely getting a challenge, right? And if the numbers are moving the way they are, like in that special election in Tennessee this week, Van Orden's got some stuff to worry about. Stile, he runs with the top of the ticket. That district has been competitive. Go back to 2022, Tony Evers, I think, lost it by like 500-some votes, or took 500 fewer votes than Tim Michaels in that district in his governor's race. So there's an option there, possibly there. But with the current maps, Stile's been pretty solid. The map's probably going to change before 2026. If you go through like this whole process, yes, Mark Elias and his partisan gerrymander lawsuit, he wants a map now. Like they've actually filed stuff saying you should decide this month on a new map. The anti-competitive gerrymandering people say no. They're kind of more of a, this is a long-term, you know, argument. We're going to lay out this stuff and go through this process. Their eyes more on 2028. So my point is, I think Stile is probably still in good shape for 2026. 2028, there's a new map. That might change some things. What's interesting, though, is Opportunity Wisconsin is a liberal group. They keep running ads against Brian Stile, though he's not losing anything. I get the impression that, one, they're national donors who want to kind of, like, soften him up a little bit, and two, they got their eye on the future that, yeah, in 2028, the map changes. Maybe we'd go after him. And two, if Ron Johnson doesn't run for re-election in the U.S. Senate, Brian Stile's a natural candidate to jump over and run for U.S. Senate. Democrats have learned that if you allow somebody to run against not great opponents in a district that you kind of want to win, they grow more powerful and they get more liked. Look at Scott Walker. He kept winning in Milwaukee County, a Democratic county, because he had not great opponents. Probably then to run for governor. So you can see the Stile, the same thing where in a couple of years he might run for U.S. Senate if the map changes and makes his life more difficult, or if Ron Johnson runs for secret election for U.S. Senate.
Yeah, so forever those kind of shifting dominoes. And speaking of things that are falling, Mercury Marine, this kind of shipbuilder in Marinette.
Yes, so the Navy had made a big deal, actually Donald Trump made a big deal a few years back that he selected Mercury Marine, which is a subsidiary of an Italian company, to build this new Navy ship. They're kind of smaller, more agile ships. They were going to do six of them. The Navy came back before Thanksgiving and said, actually, we're going to do two. We're not going to do the last four because there are cost overruns, design problems. Exact same thing that plagued the old program. Now we're seeing that Mercury Marine is laying off 100 people, mostly white-collar employees. There's a big question here of will the Navy come back with a new project to keep Mercury Marine kind of chugging along. The Navy says we care about shipbuilders in Wisconsin and Michigan. Timmy Baldwin says, I'm skeptical. I don't like promises. Show me the money, essentially. So keep an eye up there. There are 2,200 people employed in northeastern Wisconsin with this company. So that could be a big at risk for them if they don't come through another contract from the Navy.
So lots to pay attention to there as well. But that'll do it for us at Rewind this week. I am Anjuvan Wagtendonk.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
We'll see you next week.
This program was brought to you from the Margaret Farrell Studio.
Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.